There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you? My name is Benoit Bump. I'm a detective, and I have taken a personal interest in Max Mike movies. I work in a private capacity. This podcast was in need of a movie to continue their series, because I wanna, and you're gonna like it. They allowed me to help. Their lips were cracked with dehydration. They hadn't slept all night. They'd spent it out of doors by the state of their drooled-on sweaters and mud-stained trousers. What I saw was not two men tormented by their lack of vision, their indecision, but two men indecisive about their lack of vision. Trust me, it makes sense if you don't think too hard on it. So I asked them to let me help them. So help them I did, even though they tried to pay me with a pony. I chose for them Wake Up Dead Man, a Knives Out mystery. And now I shall step aside to let these two masters of shaky showmanship get on with their dubious little sideshow. And who are they, you might well want to know? Well, that one. That's the smart one, if I had to put a name to it. Max, tell Mike to stay on his own side, Levine. And well, the jig is up, I guess. Yes, the other guy is really me. Mike, he touched me first loose. Oh, Max, the fun we have. Don't we have the fun?
Oh, Daniel Craig isn't here?
No, that was not real Daniel Craig, although... You know, I wonder if you might call in to answer our poll questions.
Oh, I hope.
No. Speaking of which, we can't have all the fun. That's why we gave you our
poll question.
Last week, we asked who your favorite cinematic swashbuckler is. Did you have answers? Oh, yes, you sure did. Let's start off with noted author Toni Kellner. She said, quote, "Dread Pirate Roberts in The Princess Bride because he's smart and funny. Robert Shaw and James Earl Jones in Swashbuckler were great, too. And Will Turner in Pirates of the Caribbean. Do Zorro's and Robin Hood's count? Lady Hawk?" Sure. End quote. Of course they count. Thanks, Tony.
All the Lady Hawks count.
I can't help but note she said Will Turner in Pirates of the Caribbean. That's an interesting choice. I mean, it is.
Yeah,
Orlando Bloom.
Orlando.
That was weird. Why did that happen?
I don't know.
Can I just say Orlando Blue? Apparently I can't. Weird. Matt Reisman. Ooh, we have another novelist. He sent us, quote, "It's my turn for an essay." I think you have to divide this into two eras, classic and modern. My favorite swashbuckling character in every era is D'Artagnan. That said, I'm never really impressed by any actor who portrays him. My favorite swashbuckling character in the classic era is Errol Flynn's Robin Hood. But Flynn was a creep and a terrible swordsman. His flailing about has caused flinning to be a term for derision in fight choreography.
I did not know that.
I did not know that either. Basil Rathbone makes him look good because Rathbone was a talented fencer. He's definitely my favorite classic swashbuckling actor. All of his sword fights are worth watching, especially the one with Danny Kaye from The Court Jester.
Oh, God.
That said, the best classic sword fight is the climax of Scaramouche. In the modern era, my favorite swashbuckler is the barely cinematic Duncan MacLeod, who edges out Will Turner from Pirates of the Caribbean due to how the character was weakened considerably by the sequels. The best modern sword fights are the Bob Anderson choreographed fights for Viggo Mortensen in Alartis, which I don't know. It's not the best movie. It tries to condense too much into a single film, but Mortensen does a wonderful job. It's a shame he didn't do more swashbuckling after Al Artiste and Lord of the Rings, end quote. Wow. That is a lot of answer with some great perspective. Thanks, Matt. Yeah. I happen to know that he fences, so he would know.
Aha. So he puts up his own fences. That's cool. It's a good skill to have.
By himself.
You know, they say good fences make good neighbors.
Really? Where did you hear that?
Robert Frost.
Who's he? He's not trying to take over the show, is he? Robert Frost. Yeah. He can have that other path. Nobody cares.
Okay. The one that we haven't taken?
Sure. Yeah, that one. Kelly J. Cooper was next with, quote, "Mine is a twofer. Burt Lancaster as Captain Vallo and Nick Cravat as Oho in The Crimson Pirate. They brought their acrobatic skills into play and definitely understood the assignment. One of my favorite movies. They did several movies together, including one of my other favorites, The Flame and the Arrow, which is up there with The Court Jester for me," end quote. Wow.
Oh, wow.
Quite the list already. Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah.
David Meiselman posted, quote, "Inigo Montoya, you killed my father. Uh-huh. Prepare to die," end quote. Uh-huh. Wait, was that a threat? My name's not Inigo. Yeah. Oh, The Princess Bride. Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Roland Hardy wrote, quote, "Errol Flynn, he acted those campy roles with humor when he was sober," end quote. Yeah. Oh, dear. Tarnish on the golden age of Hollywood. Thanks, Roland.
Yeah, well.
Dan Schaefer said, quote, "Peter O'Toole is Alan Swan in my favorite year," end quote.
Huh. Oh, that is so much fun.
I didn't know O'Toole ever buckled swash. Thanks, Dan.
Oh, yeah.
I know nothing about that movie. I just thought it was him playing an actor, isn't it?
Kind of. It's basically him playing a sort of amalgam of Errol Flynn and a couple of others.
Oh, well, that explains it. There you go.
Without the Nazi sympathy, as far as I can tell.
Nick Hoffman said simply, quote, "Do you really have to ask Errol Flynn?" end quote. Well, we did, so thanks for answering. Jamie Kleinert was brief with, quote, "Mandy Patinkin, prepare to die," end quote. Wow, some of these answers do feel a little threatening.
Well, either that or I think she just threatened Mandy Patinkin.
Yeah, what'd he ever do to you?
Ah. Oh,
thanks, Jamie.
Yeah.
Regan McStravick's answer was, quote, "Peter O'Toole, my favorite year for sure," end quote. Another one for old Pete. Thanks, Regan. Dave. Sent, quote, "I feel like the swashbuckling movie is a thing of the past. I love Gene Kelly in The Three Musketeers and Errol Flynn as Robin Hood. But in films aimed at my generation, only The Princess Bride comes to mind. There was the Robin Hood with the Bryan Adams song, but the villain stole the show, and I can't even remember who played Robin." And, Dave, that was Kevin Costner, which explains why you couldn't remember him.
quite understandable. You don't usually get Robin Hood with a Kansas accent.
Yeah. Continuing with Dave, quote, "Oddly, though all the good swashbuckling stories, Three Musketeers, Robin Hood, Ivanhoe, Scarlet Pimpernel, are European, I can think of a good European swashbuckling movie. Maybe La Magnifique with Jean-Paul Belmondo or the Fantomas TV series. In Japan, swashbuckling isn't much of a thing either, though the Lupin Sansei Castle or Cagliostro animation may qualify.
Oh, yeah.
Or maybe the Bored Hatamoto series. Love me a good Bored Hatamoto movie," end quote. Well,
I don't know. They're so dull.
I don't know that last one, though. Having the word bored in the title doesn't sound good. Thanks, Dade.
Yeah, cool.
Rob Butler posted, quote, "I'm torn between Dante Bosco's Rufio in Hook or Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow," end quote. Don't be torn.
Wow.
I'll take both. Thanks.
Yeah.
Keith wrote,
no, you're right about Keith wroting. No, what? Damn it!
Quote, "Forrest Whitaker in Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai," end quote.
Wow.
That's an interesting stretch of the term swashbuckler.
I would not have thought swashbuckler, but sure.
Yeah, thanks, Keith.
Okay. That kind of an... kind of a modern swashbuckler, yeah.
Oh, your favorite inventor is next, Max, and who might that be?
Who might? Who? Tell me.
Richard Tatum.
Oh, of course. Oh, yes, I used my Tatum just last week.
Mine leaves a rash.
A couple of the flanges have fallen off.
Yeah, he's deleted the flanges. Apparently that was an issue. But anyway, Richard Tatum was next with, quote, "Weirdly, Nicol Williamson is Sherlock Holmes in the 7% solution," end quote. And that might be an even more interesting stretch of the term.
Huh.
Thanks, Richard.
There is a big sword fight in it, a couple of them.
I've never seen it.
Yeah.
I know Nicol Williamson from two things, Columbo and Excalibur, and that's it.
Yep.
Tyler Stewart sent, quote, "Antonio Banderas and Anthony Hopkins in Mask of Zorro," with a nod to Catherine Zeta-Jones. Also, Danny Kaye and the Court Jester, at least part of the time, end quote.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think Antonio swashbuckles in his spare time just for fun.
I think so, but only when, but if he's having trouble, he just reaches for some Nizanex.
Yes, or Honey Nut Cheerios. Thanks, Tyler. Jen Ing simply posted a gif of Puss in Boots. Thanks, Jen. If you have not seen the last Puss in Boots movies, I actually have to highly recommend it. I really liked it.
Oh, Puss in Boots is the Last Wish.
Yeah.
That was terrific.
It was
really
fun.
Was.
Yeah.
Which is good because the first one, not so much.
Yeah. From the mailbag, it seems there's an envelope stuffed by our longtime correspondent, Billolading Max.
Ah, Billolading, Billolading, Billolading.
This is what he sent. Quote, Where is the rum? The rum is gone. Why is the rum gone? I'm going to try and do that accent, but I'm sure many will say this. You'd be surprised. But Captain Jack Sparrow of Pirates of the Caribbean 2003 gets my vote. This character, Johnny Depp's masterpiece, is a straight character in the script, i.e. nothing crazy about him. Just a stock character hero who makes funny quips, loves drink and women, and wants his pearl back. A side story to the Will Elizabeth romance who keeps scenes moving. Depp wisely identified that the film would be dull and formulaic if Sparrow was dull and formulaic. And so Jack Sparrow became eccentric, cunning, charming, unpredictable, roguish, theatrical, resilient, all at once. A manly man on paper became addled, manic, greedy, bordering on mentally ill. Depp jettisoned sex appeal. He insisted on the heavy makeup, wig, and always being clothed to ensure audiences listened to him. The production crew and cast were weirded out. Hands were wrung. The producers sent notes. Luckily, Depp's stardom was such that he could not be talked down from his vision, and the production proceeded. Depp single-handedly made this throwaway of a film into a blockbuster. People loved his dark comedic performance. Word of mouth, remember that? Packed the theaters all summer, stupefying Disney, who expected this to be a placeholder throwaway of a film. Everything else, including megawatt stars Keira Knightley and Orlando Bloom, that's so weird, just fade into the background. Is there a more entertaining, gold-plundering, Avast Me Hearty's pirate and cinematic history? If there is, they've been eclipsed by Depp. It's one of the great crimes of the Oscars that Depp did not win Best Actor for his performance. Sean Penn won for Mystic River, who no one ever saw or will see. I've seen Mystic River.
Me
just
too.
Saying. Anyway, he continues. Hans Zimmer's score, his best ever, is also an unqualified treat. Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and 3 are overly long, so long that I forgot the plots halfway through and stopped trying to follow whom was screwing over whom. Truly, it's all about Depp's scenes. You can fast forward through the rest. Yo-ho, yo-ho, a pirate's life for me. I love this song, end quote. And apparently, Johnny Depp. Thanks, Bill.
Arr.
I have to say, he's not wrong.
He's not entirely wrong, no.
Except up the Mystic River part.
Yeah, Depp did base the character on
Pepe Le Pew and Keith Richards.
What a combo. And it works.
It did work.
I did like that in the second one, they get Keith Richards to play his dad.
Yeah. I also have to say, too, it is a film that somehow makes Orlando Bloom. That's so weird. It makes him dull. He's really not very interesting in that film.
Nope.
Although he doesn't really need to do that much. Anyway.
Stand there and look pretty.
Yep. That means we take a sidestep off to the website where our international fan of mystery, Vince, likes to leave his mark.
Who could he be?
It's Vince. I just said that.
Oh.
And this week is no exception. Quote, Douglas Fairbanks in the 1920 Mark of Zorro is just amazing in his swashbuckling action. Fairbanks is so athletic and graceful, it's fantastic, end quote. Wait, was that the only vote for Fairbanks?
I think so.
Wow. Thanks, Vince.
How did he do such great stunts with such little feet?
Yeah.
There's a deeper F.
Yeah. So, we have that blinking light of hopes and dreams. Our hotline, Max.
My Valentine is calling.
Gussie yourself up. It's time for your heavy breathing exercises. Let's see what Doris has to say.
Hello, Max Mike Movies. Hi, Max. This is Doris Simplemeyer here to answer your poll question, which happens to be, who is your favorite swashbuckler? I'm going to come up with a weird one because I'm different, right? I mean, I could go with, all the standard ones. But I always kind of liked Oliver Platt in the Three Musketeers from 1993 with Charlie Sheen and Kiefer Sutherland. Not so much Chris O'Donnell as D'Artagnan was okay, but there was something about Oliver Platt. I just really liked him in that movie. So I'm going to go with that one. I hope you guys have a wonderful week, and I hope to listen to the episode next week. And it's going to be a cool one, I'm sure, because it's you guys. And I'll see you later, Max. Bye.
Wow. The 1990 whatever Three really? Musketeers, Oliver okay. Platt. Did not see that coming.
He is fun in that, I got to say. He's honestly, he and Charlie Sheen are the only ones who look like they're having a good time in that movie.
Well, Charlie Sheen, I have this feeling, is having a time not for reasons of having to do with acting, yeah, but I could be wrong.
Likely,
Chris
likely.
O'Donnell's in it.
Yeah, he was there.
I literally know him from three things. From that, a movie called Circle of Friends, and his part in Batman. Bat-Devils.
Bat credit card.
But Max, it's time for you to answer your own. Oh, thank you, Doris. I should have thanked you. Thank you, Doris.
Yes,
we appreciate
it. Thank you, my little swashbuckling kitten.
Yeah. But Max, answer your own question for our listeners. Would you? Who's your favorite cinematic swashbuckler?
Well, there was some in here that I do agree with. You know, Errol Flynn may have been a jackass, but he was so much fun. Not just as Robin Hood, but Captain Blood and the Seahawk. He's really cool. He's at his best, like Matt said, about when he's fighting Basil Rathbone. Because, yes, Rathbone basically carries him the whole time. But I have a soft spot for Tyrone Power as Zorro.
Oh, okay.
He was so cool in that. And he reminded me, you know, really shows how the Scarlet Pimpernel affected the character, because he does that same, oh, mayhap perchance, foppish that I am, I might be Zorro. He doesn't have a catchphrase like sink me, but he does. He's the same idea, the foppish millionaire playboy who is the swashbuckler at night. You can really see how he inspired Batman. But
Batman!
Batman. I mean, there have been 900 Zorros, but I got a soft spot for Tyrone Power.
Yeah, nobody picked Guy Williams, weirdly enough.
How strange.
Yeah.
But what about you? Who buckles your swash?
I mean, I got to go with an actor who really just nailed it for both Scarlet Pimpernel and Robin Hood. And that actor is Daffy Duck. No, I'm... Am I wrong?
Ooh, ha! Parry! Spin! Dodge! Thrust!
No, I'm going to broaden the definition here, and I can easily see some people saying this doesn't count, but I'm going to go with Indiana Jones.
Oh, yeah. Why not? I mean... Wait, he doesn't use a sword.
I don't care. I just he shows you don't need one. I just... His swinging around, his daring do, his leaping off and onto things...
I think that counts. Why not?
I also just think I love the fact that he actually gets hurt. Like at the end of a fight, he's just like, ow, ow, I need to lay down now. And I really appreciate that in films. But that first film, Raiders of the Lost Ark, came out of nowhere. Nobody was looking for old serial style movies. I mean, you could argue Star Wars sort of vaguely fits in that genre or description. Nobody was looking for treasure hunting films. It was just, hey, we want to do this and it's fun. And it was awesome. And so I'm going to go with Indiana Jones.
Okay, that works.
Well, we got tons from you folks this week and we were really thankful for all of it. Don't suppose you'd mind doing it again, would you? Pretty pleased with Daniel Craig on top. We'd like to know, who is your favorite made for film detective, someone that's only shown up in movies, TV, streaming. So no Sherlock Holmes, no Batman. Timmy, don't call Batman. Nothing like that.
Hello, Batman.
Ah, Timmy. But this can include police detectives, because it doesn't have to be a private detective. Okay. So tell us who done it for you. Hmm. We have some
listener mail.
A rather random comment on our Blueski account. It seems to come from, Leslie Howard himself.
Oh my God, first real Julia Roberts and now Leslie Howard?
Well, to be fair...
apparently has risen from the grave to speak to us.
It does seem to actually be an account that is a appreciating account of Leslie Howard, but...
Oh.
They wrote, a fun listen. Oh, thank you, Leslie. Thank you. That was very nice.
I'm sure you are too.
I think they meant the episode on Scarlet Pimpernel, but
I'm sure he was fun listen to. Had he not died in 1943,
yeah. Well, Leslie, I hope you tune in often, and thank you again for the comment. We like that. But for now, let's get back to Wake Up Dead Men and
the
facts.
Before we get going, this is still a relatively recent movie, so let's just sound that spoiler klaxon to warn you all. It is a mystery, too.
Spoiler. 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 Spoiler.
Budget! $151.7 million. Wow.
Good God!
That is a lot of hard-earned cash.
Yeah, well, I think you can see it mostly went to the cast, I assume.
Well, we did this a while back and we found out how much money they gave Daniel Craig. Well, luckily it paid off because this movie raked in $2 million.
What?
Oh, right, streaming services. Oh, yeah. So there's no real way to tell how successful this movie was. But both Rian Johnson, the director, and Daniel Craig, its star, have said they'll keep making them as long as we like seeing them, they're fun to make, and they're both involved.
Yeah.
Note that a Knives Out mystery never appears in the movie itself. Johnson only bows to having it in promotional material, as the Netflix bosses thinks we won't know this film is part of a series without that tag. The thing is, by title alone, I wouldn't. This movie was released, barely, into theaters before showing up on Netflix. Originally, it was supposed to have a wider and longer run, but the bosses changed their minds, something that irked both Johnson and Craig.
You don't want to irk Daniel Craig.
No.
He doesn't irk well.
Urkel? What?
Did you do that?
This was Jeremy Renner's first movie since his near-fatal accident back in 2023. It's good to see he's back on stage.
Yeah.
Apparently, things were good on the set. Glenn Close commented, quote, "We just became this wonderful ensemble company, and we kept each other company through the whole shoot. We were always in our tent laughing, sleeping, reading, getting to know each other. It's one of the great gifts to have such an intense experience with people who you know will be your dear friends for the rest of your life," end quote. Well, now I want to be part of a Knives Out movie.
Yeah.
I want to be friends with Glenn Close.
Yeah. Me too. I want to hang out with Josh Brolin, one of those Brolins.
The title for this movie, like the other two, comes from a song, this time by U2 and their album, Pop. Although, I thought it was something played backwards on a Beatles record.
Yeah.
We've asked this many, many, many times before, but when is New York not New York? When it's really, here we go, Epping Forest, England. Whee! That's where the church was.
Sure. Yep, man, I am so tired of seeing them sub in Epping Forest for New York City. It really...
Yeah, well, you can take an Epping leap off a bridge. How about that, pal?
Ep you, pal.
And when is Josh Brolin not Josh Brolin? When you have to pancake his nude corpse, that's when. Yes, that was a fake Brolin or a stunt Brolin used for that scene. I was worried about that. It's like, I actually didn't put this in I should have put this in the trivia. The reason they didn't, one of the reasons they didn't use him, he's apparently too muscular to, like,
he's too ripped.
Yeah.
This guy was supposed to look more sort of dissolute. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know how Father Judd says he's been writing for the last hour? Well, that's exactly how long his narration lasts.
Mm, nice touch.
Hey, what is that little ditty Blanc is caught listening to on tape in his car? Why, it's the song Skimbleshanks the Railroad Cat from that show, Cats!
Yeah.
He listens to show tunes. Are we surprised? No.
No. He's also, when he plays the organ to interrupt Father Judd.
Yeah,
that's the opening bars from the overture of Phantom. Yeah.
Or March of the Angry Rabbits, as one of my friends used to call it. Do, 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 do. Do, 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 do.
Yep, that works.
Yep. Craig just can't leave James Bond behind. Like the other two movies in this series, he has co-stars that were with him in that franchise as well.
Yeah.
Andrew Scott and Jeffrey Wright were both in Craig Bond movies. And so much more, but dear gods, if we're ever going to get discussing this movie, I'd better try and wrangle this plot into something relatively short. Unless, Max, is there anything you want to throw in?
No, not really.
Okay. At a small church in upstate New York, Father Judd arrives to be second priest to an abrasive Monsignor as a sort of punishment for decking a deacon with a big mouth. It's hoped that he can help raise numbers for the flagging flock of one Father Jefferson Wicks. Did I mention that he's abrasive? Boy, howdy, is he. Every week, he singles out someone from the pulpit, though never actually naming them, and shouts fire and brimstone about how terrible a life they're leading until most of all he has left is a few hand-picked parishioners. Suddenly, in the middle of the Good Friday Mass, Monsignor Wicks falls over dead, stabbed in the back. But who could have done it? He was alone in a vestibule off the side of the main altar. Father Judd was first to his side, but he didn't do it. It's an impossible murder! In swings our dandy from down south, Benoit Blanc. He'll get to the bottom of this. Or will he? Seems there's all sorts of goings-on that have been going on behind the scenes. Wick's father was a priest before him and had a vast fortune that went missing at the time of his death. The local doctor is a hidden drunk. The science fiction author is a hack and somehow doesn't know it. Lawyer Vera has been living with a secret even she didn't know about. Martha, who runs the whole church on her own, is as fire and brimstone as Wick's, perhaps a bit too much so. Simone, a nearly crippled cello player, came for spiritual healing but doesn't seem to be getting any better. Sam, the caretaker, seems innocent enough, but what is it he does in his garage all alone at night? Cy is the political hopeful trying to use and abuse social media in his struggles to the top. Who could have done such a thing, and why? Or is this case utterly different than what it appears to be? Oh, there's so much more to this movie, so if you haven't seen it, do so and come back. We'll be here.
Yeah, yeah.
The end, sort of.
The film. I know you already sounded the klaxon, but there's no way to talk about this without spoilers.
No, it's a mystery, too. So, like, you know, that's part of the deal. Now, it did go out to theaters. Did you see it in the theater?
I did not. Largely because the same reason most people didn't. I knew I just had to wait 2 weeks and I could watch it on Netflix.
I would have gone to see it, but I literally missed it. It's like, oh, it's in theaters. I want to see it. I guess it's gone. Okay.
Yeah. That was a brief sojourn.
So here's a quick question before we get to the cast. Do you think, I know you only have a home to judge by, but do you think this is a film that would have somehow played better in the theater or not?
I think it would have. There's some visuals in there I think really would have worked better on the big screen.
Like what?
A lot of the stuff they did with light and light and shadow. I would have liked to see the light scenes in the church on the big screen. I would have liked to see the Lazarus come forth sequence on a big screen.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. I remember because it was during COVID that Dune 1 came out and we got to see it at home first run. And I liked it, but I couldn't help but think, you know, this would look much better on a big screen. And so when Dune 2 came out, I did see it on a big screen. And sure enough, it's, you know, trying to be Lawrence of Arabia in space in its grandeur, I think. But this film, I don't know that I feel that way. I think, here's the thing. It is more or less, maybe we'll come back to this, what's termed a cozy or a parlor murder mystery, because it mostly takes place in one or two rooms, and quite honestly there is the end scene where it's like, aha, you did it, you know.
So
I don't know, but we have quite the cast here, some of whom I know, some of whom I do not. The first one though, Daniel Craig.
Yes,
I think the thing I like about Daniel Craig most is his post-Bond work, where we find out, oh, you actually are really a good actor and we didn't know it.
Honestly, I think he's going to be remembered more for Benoit Blanc than he is for James Bond.
I don't know yet because it's too early to tell. The reason that I might argue is that that series of Bond films did something none of the other series did, and that they kind of gave us an arc. While you don't have to see them all, but they are connected and they do sort of, things continue on into films. And it's sort of like, and they stopped early. They don't have him Roger Mooring it up with the 30 to 40 year younger teen stars.
I think he's terrific and his accent is flawless. I mean,
just like mine. I want to say though, I find the character a little haughtier than he usually is in this film, and I don't know that I care for it.
Interesting. I thought he was fairly haughty in the second film, not so much in the first.
But the second film, we find out he's doing it on purpose to throw everybody off. And I don't know that he's doing it for that reason here. It almost seems like he's doing it because he doesn't know who did it. And we do get the impression that for most of the film, he doesn't. But, and also, I just have to ask one more question. What's with the hair?
I don't know. I think he's just like, you know what? I'm going 19th century on my hair.
Oh, he's 20th century. It's 70s. I just don't, like, he's feathering it. And I'm like, what happened? Didn't Hugh tell you before you left the house? Oh, honey, no. But whatever. Yeah, he's fun. We like Benoit Blanc. Josh O'Connor. I don't know him from anything. Do you?
Yes, I do. And I think you might also. Did you watch The Crown?
Not, only the first part of it. So
he was the young Prince Charles.
Oh, okay. Looking at his picture, yeah. I can see that now.
Yeah.
I gotta say, he's terrific.
He is really good, and you wouldn't know he was English.
No.
His accent is another one who can do a great American accent, and he's really good in this. I mean, just really
vocally,
he
kind of reminds me of the main character in Ratatouille, who is actually played by Lou Romano, one of the animators. But I thought his character, he carries the first hour of the film pretty much on his own.
Yeah.
And I buy him as an ex-boxer, and I buy him as somebody who's struggling with his anger, and I buy him as somebody who's trying desperately to do what he believes in. I think he does great. He's a great central character. Also great, Glenn Close. Okay, it's Glenn Close. I get it, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
She's wonderful in this.
She is so good. Now, the sad thing is, for a lot of it, she's kind of cartoony. Even just to the bit of where she suddenly appears behind people as a sight gag. Her confession sequence, spoiler, at the end is, I think, some of the best acting in the movie.
Yeah, she's great.
Incredibly moving. It's gripping. I really like that.
I'll also say this, Hollywood. Glenn Close is an actor who is older than most of the people you're willing to sign to a movie. And she had no problem letting you do lots of close-ups on her. And she has an amazing face. Take note of this. People above the age of 30 can have a lot to give, even just facially. And she does. She has a wonderful face for this. And it's not like I'm saying she's hauntingly gorgeous. She just has a really interesting face. And hats off to her for saying, get as close as you want.
Yep. Oh, I see what you did there. And then we've got the Reverend Thanos. Yes, that unfortunately is the first thing in my comments.
Oh, sure.
Reverend Thanos.
I think he's great.
He is terrific. He's one of those actors I kind of didn't want to like because he tended to do the same thing over and over again. And he's just, yes, I'm big and stoic. And
yes, I see.
I'm Raymond Burr, but he really does a good job. And not just in this, he's good in general. I mean,
like the Goonies.
Yes.
I'm sure he's just like, could you please stop talking about the Goonies? That was 40 years ago, okay? I've done other things since then. Wasn't he, didn't he also play Jonah Hex?
Yes, I think he did.
Okay. Yeah.
But that wasn't his fault.
Mila Kunis as the chief of police. I hate to say this, but in my advancing years, I am having trouble telling some actors apart. And I spent the entire movie going, wow, this is cool to see Selena Gomez doing another mystery show.
Oh, dear. No.
This has nothing to do with Mila Kunis and just me having trouble telling people apart. So
I thought she did a good job. She doesn't have a lot to do. But I also like the fact that they downplay how good looking she is. And they have her hair very unflattering. They don't use a lot of makeup.
Yep.
She's very no-nonsense.
And Ashton Kutcher is not in the film, which is even better.
And this is 100% Kutcher-free.
Kutcher.
There's
Kutcher? No N. Ashton Kutcher.
Well, there should be for Ninny.
Okay.
Yeah,
she's fine.
Yeah.
Jeremy Renner is Dr. Nat Sharp. Not a character we're used to seeing from him. We're used to seeing Hawkeye, because quite honestly, that's mostly what I know him for. Mm-hmm. And you can tell that the character is a little slippery. That's all I'm going to say there. But he's not sure of himself.
He pulls it off. He nails it.
Yeah. Kerry Washington as Vera, the lawyer. She's fine. Mm-hmm. She doesn't get a lot to do, but she gets a couple of scenes, especially once at the end where she's basically like, oh, so that's what's going on. Well, you can go back to the house and remove your stuff because it's going to be gone.
The simmering anger in her is really well done.
And also when she's describing, like she's talking about her father and how much she loves and is enamored of her father. And their relationship. And you could tell it's just like, oh, you are lying so much. Andrew Scott as Lee Ross. I swear I know him from somewhere. And again, I can't place him.
Did you see Sherlock?
He was in Sherlock. Okay, that's
Moriarty.
What I thought. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
He has a much smaller part here. I actually love what happens to his character. it's a sight gag at the end, but it is funny. And he plays the science fiction writer who doesn't know that he's a hack, which, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a little L. Ron Hubbard going about him. I'm not sure who else.
I mean, he could easily be the guy who wrote Food of the Gods. There's a bunch of those people on that Giorgio show that I'm not going to talk about, but he could easily be one of those authors that shows up on the Ancient Aliens.
Oh, okay.
Kaylee Spaney as Simone, the cello player. She's fine. She doesn't have a lot to do.
Very little to do, which is a shame. She's kind of an interesting character.
Yeah. Daryl McCormick as Cy Draven, the supposed brother? We don't know, but we find out later who he is. Who's trying to get into politics and is trying everything with social media and stuff to do so. Sadly, totally believable.
Absolutely believable as an influencer / political hack. Yep.
Yeah. And I got to say, he did a great job of making me hate him because I hated him.
Yeah. 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 Loathsome character and believably loathsome.
Yeah. Thomas Hayden Church, I'm almost going to say wasted.
He has so little to do, and he is actually really talented. He's done some really good stuff. Ever since Sideways, I was impressed with him.
Yeah. Speaking of wasted, we have Jeffrey Wright as Bishop Langstrom.
Oh, man. That was the main thing. I wish he'd been in it more, because Bishop Langstrom is so cool.
Yeah.
And he's in two scenes.
Yeah. Not entirely unlike Felix Leiter, but...
At
least he got to play Felix Leiter more than once, which is... Not true of most of the Felix Leiter. So, other than that, I know you wanted to mention one other actor.
I did want to mention one. It's a throwaway part.
Yeah,
Bridget Everett as Louise, the who Father Judd talks to about who rented some construction equipment. I think she's really fun. I know her mostly from Somebody Somewhere. She's the lead in that. She's done a few other things. Yeah. I think she's really, again, wasted, but she's terrific. And she's in an incredibly significant scene, I think.
So I have to say, I was utterly surprised that Rian Johnson not only picked some good actors, but got good performances out of them. Weren't you?
Yeah. Yes, I was. I saw the Star Wars movies. I was surprised by this.
Never mind. We won't talk about Star Wars. So the film opens, and we are read a letter being written by Father Judd, which I got to say, the whole opening hour, I basically didn't have any notes because I was kind of captivated by what was going on. But as soon as Monsignor Wick shows up, I said, gee, I wonder who dies.
Yeah. And by the way, there's a subtle German pun in his name.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
It's apparent.
They spell his name W-I-C-H.
Yeah.
Oh, no, actually, it's C-K-S, but there's a possible pun from the German Wichen, which means to masturbate.
Right.
Which is appropriate because whenever he does his confession with Father Judd, he always talks about not only how often he masturbated, but all of the circumstances.
Yes, and it's really horrible later when we find out that he's had his prostate out and he can't actually perform that act. And so this has all been made up just to be a jerk.
Yep.
Which brings me to my second note. I said, in another time, in another place, Wicks could have been Nick Nolte.
Yeah, that's right, Cochise. You know it. I could totally run a church.
See, there is some humor scattered about in here, and one of the funnier lines is given by Glenn Close. There's there's a big crypt outside the church, and at one point, some ne'er-do-well teenagers have come out and spray-painted wangs on it. And she is definitely horribly affronted, and she's just like kids painting rocket ships.
And I do like Father Judd and Samson just look at each other like, I'm not going to say anything, are you?
No. Well, and the sad thing is you feel that one of the reasons she doesn't know what it is she's literally probably never seen one. A real one.
Very likely. Well, we don't know about the depth of her relationship with Samson.
I get the impression that they've not done it. That just is how I feel about it.
Really? Even after he grabs her ass?
Yeah, I think she puts up with that, but that's as far as she goes. I don't know.
I'm sorry. I want that on my resume. What'd you do in the movie? I grabbed Glenn Close's ass. Oh, man! You're hired!
Yeah, we need somebody who can grab Glenn Close's ass. I'm sure you're going to get hired for many films that way.
Oh, yeah.
This one has a feeling of one of those small British villages. Apparently, there is a reason for that.
Yes, well, there is a lot of sort of Somerset murders about this. There's also, if you notice, there's a bunch of little visual clues in this movie.
Okay.
Initially, and this happened, it's done twice, once by Father Judd and once by Blanc, when they're looking out the window of Judd's bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some stained glass, and they're looking through a pane that is diamond-shaped.
Oh.
This happens twice, and a diamond plays a big part in this movie.
And James Bond was in a film called Diamonds Are Forever.
Coincidence?
It might be. Actually, yes, could actually have been done on purpose. Who knows?
It might have been.
I'm going to ask you, because you know more about these things than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Diamond, huh?
Yeah.
Was that a possible color for a diamond?
Oh, yeah. Diamonds come in just about any color you can imagine.
But the best one are chocolate diamonds.
Oh, God, yes, that. We got a bunch of brown diamonds we can't sell. Let's call them chocolate. Good, yes. Chocolate. What about these piss yellow ones? Champagne. Good, champagne.
Yeah, here's my next question, though. How big would that diamond have to be worth $80 million?
Roughly? Well, that diamond, I think they undervalued.
Really?
Is that? Yeah. Diamonds, I mean, that's almost that grandma's doorknob. I know. Diamonds that large. And that had to be 300 carats, maybe more.
Okay.
They are worth an ungodly amount, depending on the clarity. And they play up how clear and how perfect it looks. The color, I think, is weird. I mean, obviously, they're trying to get it kind of apple-colored or something.
I mean, it's kind of...
Because it's called Eve's Apple.
Yeah. It's kind of almost urine-colored.
Yeah, it's sort of brownish, reddish, yellow. It's weird.
It is,
but I think it's distinctive. And a diamond, if it was a good clarity of that size, that would easily be worth $80 million.
Okay, cool. I wasn't sure because, of course, seeing wealth melted into that tiny little thing, you wonder, really? $80 million for that?
I know. You look at that. Because
Grandma's got 10 of those.
It's a rock.
Yeah.
Have a rock that's worth more than your neighborhood.
So not too long into the film, we find out about the missing $80 million, which eventually we don't know it's a gem at that point. I don't know about you, but I quickly wrote down, gee, I wonder if the missing money is in the crypt.
Yeah, that was the first. Okay, it's somehow in the crypt. I did not think of it.
It is.
Yes, it is, in a rather gross way. As it turns out, Thanos Sr. Converted his money into the diamond to keep money away from mankind because money, evil, bad, pursuit of wealth, blah, 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 captured scientist, blah, blah, blah. And he swallows it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was watching that, my first thought is, no, he doesn't.
Well, to be fair, he swallows it and then dies. So that's...
Yeah. Now, what I can figure, and this is one of the things I like about this movie, is not everything is spelled out. They let you figure it, or at least come up with your own conjecture.
Yeah.
When we see him drinking before, I think he was either poisoning himself or numbing his throat so he could swallow it.
Well, we're going to come back to that because I have some questions, but that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I got it. As I said, the first hour, I was just like riveted. I didn't write many notes because I'm like, okay, then what happened? And then what happened? And who are these people? And we know who's going to die. Okay, then what happened? It's like, and then we watch the murder and it's like, please tell me there's a secret panel in the back of the closet. There isn't.
No.
I do not guess these things ever.
No, I'm always wrong. I don't even try usually because I never get it. I can't think that way.
My one note was, did he do it to himself? Because
that is one of all those references to the Hollow Man, which is, by the way, a real book. That is one of the seven locked room mystery solutions that the detective in there comes up with, is the guy killed himself but made it look like murder.
Right.
That is not what happens here.
No, it's not. But we're probably going to talk to it, so just so you know. I also do have to say that there are some points in the movie that don't work. One of them is the blood of Monsignor Jefferson Wicks looks very much like chocolate sauce.
The color's a little strange. The viscosity's kind of weird.
Yeah, but that's
okay. Didn't take me out of it, though.
I just was like, why isn't this not red? I don't understand, but okay, whatever. Maybe because you wouldn't see it otherwise, because he was wearing red vestments, and the little devil's head is red. Mm. I got to say, though, if you're wanting to tell a mystery, I love the fact that we watch the murder happen, And everybody who's a major suspect is accounted for in our view.
Yeah. We don't see any way it could have happened either.
No. And of course, Benoit isn't when he shows up. And this is something that Rian Johnson has said he does. And we've noted in the past, like in our episode on Glass Onion, that everything is there. Like, he does put things, he doesn't Agatha Christie stuff in later.
No. Looked out the window and saw this.
This person who no one had ever heard of suddenly shows up. Yeah, he doesn't, if there's a slip that somebody makes or if something happens, it's in the film. And I was just sitting there going, there's nobody there. And, well, it's obviously not Father Judd. He's on the altar. He's doing the show. And all of the parishioners who are going to be suspects, the only people left in the pews, are out in the pews. So I like that. I like, not it being inobvious. And I especially like the idea of an impossible crime where it's not a matter of you have to figure out how did they do that?
Yeah.
Now, when they came around to the part where we find out he's been stabbed, did that make it easier or harder for you to figure out how he died?
It made it harder. I was like, what? Okay, poisoned I could get, especially once they find he had a hidden flask and he was, imbibing a little of the old Holy Spirit, if you know what I mean, on a Red regular Dog basis.
Mad Dog 2020.
Yeah. Someone's gotten into the sacramental wine.
Thank you, Loretta.
But, that made it, it's like, wait, how, what? No, that made it much worse.
Yeah.
Visually, but I want to talk a little bit about the visuals in the film.
Sure.
Not just the plot. The way they play with light, I got to say, at times is a tad hitting you over the head. This is where Rian Johnson, you remember Rian Johnson and subtlety have never really been introduced.
Okay. You're not talking about when the sun comes out from behind the clouds, are you? Twice.
Yes, I am. I'm also talking about when Blanc is talking in the church and the light gets very cold, gray, and clear. So everything is rational. And then when Judd is talking, the sun comes out from behind a cloud and the place is bathed in soft, golden, holy light.
And Annie won't stop singing.
Yeah.
It's well, all right. So for folks who may not be of this interest, the first hour, at least, is a very religious-centric film. It is very much about faith. It is very much about the church. It is very much about our main character, Father Judd, who himself is a very faithful Jesus saved me sort of guy. Mm-hmm. If that's not to your liking, this might not be the movie for you. But then Benoit Blanc shows up.
I kneel at the altar of the rational.
And it's like a bucket of cold water on a candle. Yep. He really just comes in, and he's very nice about it. He's just like, I don't go for that sort of thing. You know, I don't believe. I believe in this. I believe in that. I actually thought that that was a really interesting contrast, because at first I thought, well, is the filmmaker trying to bring forth his own philosophy or not? And it seems like most of the characters in this film are of more of a religious bent. But then the ostensible star of the series shows up and says, no, that's all hogwash. Not exactly, but he is not a believer. And I really liked that contrast.
Mm-hmm. No, that was a really nice touch. I liked when Father Judd, it says he's having his Paul on the road to Damascus moment, which is where Paul is struck blind and he finds Jesus, basically. And Craig just goes, it was probably just a bad case of pink eye.
Well, yeah, I mean, we don't have to get into discussion about that, but there is a point where Judd breaks down religion and he says, look, I know it's storytelling. I know it's all, in a way, it's flim-flammery, but if it gets you to consider and think about something that may be a universal truth, is that such a bad thing? And I actually appreciated that too, because he's kind of seeing a little bit more from Benoit Blanc's side. And it was just, it was something I did not expect to enjoy in this film. It's like, just kill somebody and let me find out who did it, all right? But I thought that that was an interesting counterpoint.
I thought that Father Judd's religious journey is the best part of the movie. I love when they're trying to get information about who rented. So they know the crypt was going to be open. They found out that someone had rented the equipment to open the crypt like a week before the Monsignor died.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make sense unless he knew something. And they're trying to get information about who put in the order, and they're talking to Louise, mm-hmm. who, you know, Bridget, and she just keeps wanting to talk about it. Oh, you know, he was a real nice. And Judd is desperate to get the information as quickly as possible, and then he realizes, you know, when she says, "Father, could you pray for me?" And he stops and just goes, "What's going on?" And she starts telling about it. Her mother is dying, and she has a brain tumor that's making her say terrible things. And as he says later, "This is why I became a priest. I don't want to fight the world. I want to help people. I want to embrace them. And that's, he does in that moment, that is what a priest is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. You know, he gives comfort. He gives an ear. He lets her know she isn't alone.
Yeah.
I think that's a really effective and really nice sequence.
It is. And again, Josh O'Connor is just great in this film. And it's all about Judd. Yeah, it's about the mystery, too. Mm-hmm. But you're right. It is really about him seeing things from multiple angles and staying true to what he believes in, you know, whether it's literally scripture or not. What did you think of the pacing?
I think the pacing is really good. I think it moves along nicely. I think there are times it slows down, but I think there are times it needs to. And this movie is almost 2.5 hours long, and I don't think it felt like it.
I thought the movie was a little bit too long. I think there was a little bit of meandering that I would like there have been less of. But the thing is I was really interested most of the time. Mm-hmm. And again, there's some things in here that I'm like, really? Like, solving the murder relies on VHS tape.
Sure, why not?
Where did that come? Like, you have a working VCR. Really? Really? Okay. We're getting close on time, but I do have some talking points here. And this will involve talking about the end. So, again, was the method of death with the remote control squib hidden in the devil's head a bit too much for you?
My main thing was there were so many things that could have gone wrong. Mm-hmm. Not the least of which is a lot of it is dependent on a drunk idiot doctor.
Right.
Who is one big screw up. And he could have easily messed it up a dozen times.
And we see him drinking in the church before.
However, you know, this is clear. This plot is designed by someone who got it all from mystery books, not like they're a career criminal. So, yeah, I thought it worked. I think it's a little, the thing is, Blanc made it sort of more complicated than it had to be. The actual solution is fairly straightforward.
Yeah, but it also relies on something else that I wanted to ask about. Mm-hmm. So they make a big deal about the overdose of this drug being taken and that it's 10 minutes from when you drink it, your lips go numb and you die. Because we see this happen twice with this particular drug.
Pentobarbital, yeah.
Yeah. So why does Wicks keel over so fast?
We don't know when he started drinking it.
They only show him doing it once at the end because he's running the whole show until that point. And they make a big deal about saying he has to go back there to fortify himself. And initially we think it's just to catch his breath. But then
could have been a much larger dose. Pentobarbital can work fast if you take too much of it.
I'm beginning to wonder how it affects the taste of your night booze? Panther or whatever you're drinking.
I don't know. Alcohol covers a myriad of sins that way.
I don't know. It was like we're making a big deal about the 10-minute thing. It's going to happen twice in the movie, but he just keels right over. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Also, who took the flask from Father Judd and what happened to it?
I figured it had to be Martha. She would have had access to his room.
But why would she know he had it?
Because she couldn't find it. She knew it would be in there, in that vestry or whatever it was called, in the closet. And it's gone. And he was the only... Well, no, that's right. A bunch of people were in there. I don't know.
Yeah. But we are at now 55 minutes, so we need to get to that point. Is there anything last thing you want to throw in before we get to the end?
I do love that line that Cyrus uses when he's convincing the Monsignor he needs to leave the church and go global. Give me 4 years, you could be president. And the scary thing is, I believe it!
I don't like that part.
Yeah.
But the part I do like is when we decide, wake up, dead man, was it worth seeing? Is it a good murder mystery? Does it work as a film or not?
The finish.
So, Max...
Huh? What? I didn't do it.
You've seen it twice, right? Once when it first came out on Netflix and then for the show.
Yep. Yep.
Now, if I remember correctly, when we did our show on Glass Onion, you said, I really like Knives Out. I'm not as big a fan of Glass Onion.
That is true. I think this one's at least a match for the first one.
Really?
Yes, I do. Not so much for the story. The first one, the story is the thing. This is, I think, the acting. The performances are so good in this. The characters are so interesting. They start out looking kind of cliche, and they turn out, most of them aren't.
Mm-hmm.
I think this one is as good as the first. I certainly enjoyed it as much. I think the first one was tighter, though.
Mm-hmm.
It moved along a little better. It wasn't quite as long. But I think this one is really good. Again, for the performances. Not as much for the story. I thought the story of the first one, that was more of an, oh!
Well, they liked the story in the first one so much, they redid it in the second one.
Yeah. This one, I was more, okay, can you just tell us how it happened already?
I didn't have any idea.
I didn't either. I just wanted him to tell me.
Yeah.
So what about you? You saw it also early, didn't you?
No, I just saw it just
you've never
a couple
seen
days
it.
Ago.
Okay.
Nope. Just for the show. I keep meaning to see it, which is why I wanted to do it in this series. Because it's like,
okay.
I keep meaning to watch this. Now I have a reason to watch it, so I'll watch it.
Okay.
Because
so
I like the first one. I enjoyed the second one more than you did, especially the second time around for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, I would put this one second to the first one. I would not put it on par. But I will say this, in the end, I want to see it again, if only to try to make sense of all the small details and look for things. Mm. And if a movie can make you want to see it again, that's got to mean something, right?
Yep, I think so.
As far as the mystery goes, I mean, there's some pretty fantastical stuff in here. We have Rising from the Dead, and then part of me is like, really? We're going to do this. Okay. But like you said, the performances are really good. Josh O'Connor kind of carries the film. And I'm not saying that nobody else does anything, but if you don't have a strong actor playing that part, the film's not going to work nearly as well, because we care about him.
We do.
My emotions were kind of fluctuating along with his. And again, I thought Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc was good, but I thought Benoit Blanc was a little haughty to start. Like, he's a little too full of himself. And I don't know. I didn't like that as much, but I do like parts when he gets like caught listening to show tunes and stuff like that. And I do like how he figures it out. And I'm perfectly happy being fooled and not knowing who did it, because I'm not even trying at this point.
I also think there was more humor in this movie than in the first one, probably in the second one too. This was funnier.
He doesn't actually say the truth is out there, but he does kind of say the truth
comes close.
Out there.
And also, I just really like the closing, which is sung out with this hymn, Come On Up to the House, sung by Tom Waits.
Sure, because nothing says religion like Tom Waits.
Yep.
Actually, sometimes he does. But yeah, if you've enjoyed the first or second or both of the Knives Out movie, I would recommend this one if you haven't seen it. And if you have Netflix, what's holding you back? You're already paying for it. But you know what you shouldn't hold back from, and that is our poll question.
So
we'd like to know, who is your favorite made-for-film or TV detective? Someone who only shows up in movies, TV,
no
streaming.
No adaptations.
No adaptations, so no Batman, no Sherlock Holmes especially, no Agatha Christie characters. So just made-for-TV love you. But there are many ways for you to tell us how you made for TV love us.
Tell us what they are.
Well, first off, you can email us directly at us@maxmikemovies.com. We can get email from you or lots of other folks who like to write us. Tell us if you liked the show. Tell us, maybe, who knows, Leslie Howard's still listening. I don't know. Tell us if you didn't like the show. Tell us if you have ideas that we should for a series we should do, or movies we should add to series. Always happy to hear from you. And we'd love to quote you on the show.
Yes, tell us how Mike is always wrong.
By saying that Max is a really intelligent person. See, oh, there I am, wrong again.
Hey!
You can go right to our website, maxmikemovies.com. All the episodes are there. Use the search function. It's a great way to find out if we've covered a movie, or just go and listen to one about your favorite movies.
Mm-hmm.
You can then go to one of the many pages that we have on social media. We have a site on Facebook, Blueski, and currently Mastodon, although we're kind of thinking
it's so lonely
nobody
there.
Out there. We might just take that down because nobody cares.
Yeah.
So yeah, Max Mike Movies on all of those. If there is a podcast app out there, we're on it. There's tons we don't even know about. We show up, we get questions in email from ones we've never heard of saying, you know, you're number 19 on the Noir podcast list. And I'm like, really? Okay.
Huh?
Yeah. Lastly, if you want to make Max's heart go all a flutter, you'll call us on our hotline, just like Doris. And that number is 617-398-7266. Once again, 617-398-7266. But
operators are sitting around ignoring you.
as I always do. We have no operators. Yep. There's just you, and even you don't answer the phone.
I could if I wanted to.
Exactly, but he doesn't. But what he does want to do is tell us, what movie are we going to watch next week as part of this series? Because I want to, and you're going
to
like it.
This was one I kind of wanted to hook into a previous series, but we never got to it.
Oh.
And it's just one I used to love when I was young, and I have no idea how it's going to hold up. I really don't.
Really?
But I really want to see if, in fact, it's still good, or if it's earned a demerit, demerit.
Uh-oh. I know what that means.
We are going to get funky with the Ramones.
Who are the Ramones?
Yes. Rock and Roll High School.
Oh,
yes,
great.
We are.
Riboflavin, wheat germ.
Yes, wheat germ is with Joey, Markey, and all the gang.
Uh-huh. Dee Dee. Yeah.
Yep. Enjoy.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.